So we come to what we commonly call our last meeting of this session. I know you come out of love, that you come out of a true urge for the holy life, at least in some degree or other. And therefore there is a meeting between all of us, one with everyone else. And this meeting in its reality is a true communion, or at least it is a reflection of true communion. We may, of course, agree or disagree with the views which we hold or exchange. Bear in mind what the Buddha said about views, ditthi, when he talked of asava, ditthi asava, one of the cankers of mere views. Remember also what he said about the Aryan silence. He said to his bhikkhus, bhikkhus, when you are gathered together in conclave, let your talk be about Dhamma. Otherwise, sit in silence. The Buddha had so completely realized the futility of views and opinions. How we bandy about our opinions and beliefs and convictions and so forth. Is not that considerably the imposition of the self as a mere thinker upon the other person or society? If there is silence, silence in the real sense, bodily and psychologically, then we can become aware of the other, what we commonly call the other person's mind or psychical state, because a subtler sensitivity in each of us functions. And in that subtler sensitivity, if it is a true sensitivity, the element of compassion as a living force is present. Then we, if we desire to converse, there can be true conversation. Haven't we noticed how often what we call a conversation is a monologue by a person who simply can't stop chattering away, or who is so conceited that he must fling his views about or make a noise somehow or other, especially verbally, speaking out aloud in order to express himself, as he calls it. impose himself, disturb the peace of God. So, when there is a true meeting, there is a state of communion. And in the state of communion, there is rejuvenation. Just as in dreamless slumber, we experience rejuvenation. Why? Because there is no intrusion of desire, no intrusion of the psychical conflict between this idea and that idea and so forth. When there is no such intrusion, this rejuvenation takes place. Because life in its essential nature, in its pure nature, is able to operate without being obstructed by our desires and thoughts and confusions and inner states of conflict. Our dreams represent all that is left unworked out during the working day. The working out fully, completely during the working day depends upon our mindfulness. If we are truly mindful, really paying full attention, then there is nothing left over to deal with. So our sleep is the sleep of the innocent child. Dreamless. And during our waking day, we are free of all fantasies, daydreaming. The Holy One has no fantasies during the day, no dreams when he sleeps. It's a strange fact. And modern science is beginning to understand quite recently that this is an actual fact in connection with the waking state and the sleeping state. In dreamless slumber, which means complete quietude of the entire organism, one is in the utterly harmless state. And because one is in the utterly harmless state, no self-consciousness intrudes upon and disturbs the state of harmony with the environment. Therefore, there is the resurrection of life. But it is an unconscious state. It's an unconscious resurrection. There is no ascension which takes place there. When we wake up, then the vigilance center at the back of the brain there begins to operate again. Everything starts up once more. Because we are still psychically ill, in the ill state, in dukkha. Mindfulness, if properly carried out, resolves innumerable problems. In fact, what is a problem in the unmindful state is not a problem at all, although the situation, the circumstance is the same. A problem comes into being because we associate the limited self with its particular desires, wanting things to be thus instead of what they actually are. which is our problem. The problem is myself, essentially. Myselfness. If I am mindful, I am awake to that fact. Then there's no problem. If a friend of mine, an acquaintance, someone close to me, someone about whom I know, if he has a problem, if he is suffering, and because of sympathy for him, for love, one is involved with him and longs to help him, then one can help him best if one is completely mindful. Because in that state of mindfulness, one's own psyche is poised, it's calm. Otherwise, I add my own turmoil to his turmoil and difficulty. So we are only worsening the situation rather than improving it. Be poised and quiet within, mindful. And then what help can be given will not be obstructed in the act of giving. Except, of course, by the other person, because we can't order another person to be mindful or do the right thing. He has to do it on his own. But if he feels our healing influence upon him, then, to his surprise perhaps, he will say, "Oh, I felt so much better." Whether you were present and talking to him, or whether you were absent, he experiences a sense of betterment, and he doesn't know why. Now you see, communion, interrelationship works freely. This is just one of many subtle ways in which true compassion and true wisdom work. As we have said over and over again, there is no such thing as compassion which is not also wisdom. It's always a case of wise compassion and compassionate wisdom. And that is the state in which there can be a meeting. A true joining together. You know, the definition of yoga. Yogas chitta vritti nirodha. Yoga is the release out of the state, the conflicts and confusions of the fluctuations of the mind. Chitta vritti, the fluctuations of the mind. So one of the essential aspects of yoga consists in mindfulness, understanding these fluctuations, looking at them fully. As I said yesterday, I think, where the psyche is concerned, the observation, the mindfulness, the diagnosis and the medicine are identical. And that is what releases the state of healing, which is not a getting rid of a disease. A whole making of the psyche. The psyche has no separate organs. We can, of course, for convenience, analyze the psyche and the psychical processes and all that. That's all useful, helpful, where intellectual understanding is concerned. But the psyche as psyche is simply a word to express the fact that the living organism constantly expresses thoughts, feelings and so forth, goes through all this intellectual, emotional process. And that process we call psyche. And that process takes place because, just for the sake of convenience, we'll talk of psyche as if there was something called the psyche, which we can call the psyche, is rooted in the brain and the nervous system and is completely bound up with the activity of the brain, with the activity of the ductus glands, in fact with the entire electrochemistry of the body. If you know the whole of the body, you also know the whole of the psyche. If you can really know the whole of the psyche, you will also know the whole of the body. This marriage made in heaven, which we talked about some time back, and its worldly counterpart, the masculine and feminine elements in each and every single living organism, the existential being, when those two are clearly understood and harmonized, then that is the heavenly marriage on earth. And in that marriage, there is no desire, passion, uncontrollable behavior involved. It is pure. And therefore, there is the state of timeless conjugation, between the masculine and feminine elements in our own constitution, be we men or women. And that timeless conjugation brings into being the immaculate conception. What is conceived? The Buddha nature is the child. The Christ consciousness is the child. And so you can use the terms of any other religion. And the birth of that is a virgin birth, in the true sense. And virginity is that state of purity whose context is the eternal, the immortal, the infinite, nondescript. Sweet are the uses of mindfulness, leading to understanding first, and to the full release of this extraordinary energy called wisdom, which functions immediately. Pure intelligence, seeing the truth at once. Now, in all this, the fact that we meet is involved. We say out of gratitude, out of affection, out of respect, "Oh, you've helped me so much and I'm very grateful for it." Perfectly true. The affection, the gratitude is there. We must clearly bear in mind that the gratitude and affection is not directed to a self-professing teacher. People always sort of say, "Oh yes, of course, he's so modest that he says he's not a teacher, but actually he's a great teacher." Well, that's absurd. It isn't so. I am not teaching anybody anything. But by opening out my being to you, freely, unreservedly, not hoping or expecting anything as a consequence, but because, well, rather funny terms, it's the nature of the beast here, you see. And as you do that in your turn, you and I learn from each other. It's true that during the meeting, this person here is the speaker. But do believe me, I exclusively am not the speaker. You are all speaking through me and with me. Because if one really opens oneself out to all one's fellow beings, if one really opens oneself out that way, there is a silent interchange going on which underlies the audible interchange when one speaks. It underlies it. And the speaker, if he happens to be sensitive enough, he senses everybody's psyche, everybody's whole being, the changing existential being. People often say to me, I had so many questions in my mind when I came, and you answered all of them without my saying a word. They say, how do you do it? I don't know. This is how it happens. But this is how it happens in so many spheres. When you go to a university, for instance, and you have a really wonderful lecturer, a master of his particular subject, and if you pay attention, and he is also of that sort, then in that silent interchange, in his presence, you understand things which were so difficult to understand and so perplexing. You know that cantata of Bach, which contains a wonderful aria, beautiful, it's a beautiful melody too. See, see, see what wonders love can do. Truly, what wonders love can do. There is a meeting between the singer and the listener. And both singer and listener exchange with each other all the time. I learn from all of you all the time. I owe a deep debt of gratitude to all of you who come here. So I never feel that, this is our last meeting and then perhaps we'll meet again next year. Since we have truly met, at least in some measure, years ago, from years ago, that meeting, that communion, that state of communion, that silent flow of interrelationship, of love, of beauty, of goodness, of truth, goes on silently. Do you think I can raise a finger, or you can raise a finger like a policeman does and stops the traffic and stop the universal flow of energy? Once that energy starts up, it continues. It grows and grows. So you see, love cannot be cultivated. Wisdom cannot be acquired. They grow from within. They are living functions of transcendence itself through us limited human beings. So there is no cause for sadness or a feeling of a certain sort of pathetic mood. Let the mood be truly joyous. If joy arises only when we finally physically meet and are together, then that joy is something which does not belong to the living truth. It is the temporal thing. Note what the Buddha says with respect to the fourth jhana. With the going down of all joy and all sorrow. That's where he introduces that going down of all sorrow. And he talks about the fourth jhana, not for the first three jhanas. Very significant. This is what it behoves us to study carefully. And we study it not by clinging to the words, but letting the words speak to us, we being quiet. That way the within emerges and there is true understanding which comes. And with that there is peace, there is beauty, there is happiness. Happiness and beauty and so forth, in the limited existential sense for us as psychophysical organisms, as we live our daily life. But it also evokes a harmonious note of response out of the transcendent, out of the great archetypal energies which function on a cosmic scale. Hasn't every one of you experienced those remarkable moments, not only moments, but sometimes periods of time lasting perhaps months, in which you were in a state which was nirvanic in nature? Then it passed away. Because the psyche itself, still imperfect, can be provoked by the circumstance to such a degree that it falls into a state of turmoil. What is one of the remarkable characteristics not only of the Buddha, but of the great spiritual teachers, the truly perfected holy ones. What is one of the remarkable characteristics? They don't oscillate like a seesaw. They don't have to strive to equilibrate. Inward poise is an extraordinary indescribable thing, dynamic and not moving from a here to a there. It's a vibrating imperfection in the eternal, the immortal, the infinite here now, the point instant. One of the deep meanings of samadhi. So now, this is the kind of thing that perhaps is slowly emerging with the developmental process of mankind in human beings. And the Buddha Dhamma has so many points of excellence which distinguish it very specially. Distinguish it not in the sense of superiority over any other true Dhamma. They are all valid. The Christian, the Buddhist, the Hindu, the Zarathustrian, the Islamic. Look at the works of the mystics all over the world. How extraordinary they are. What profound, not agreements, but unity there is between that which, when formulated, appears to be different from the other formulation. Truth is one, surely. The truth in the supreme sense is one. But the Buddha Dhamma has its own speciality, its remarkable psychological perception, superb psychology. That's its strong point. The other religions have their own strong points like that. And not a single one is superior or inferior to the other. When one really sees that, one is really loving. One is in the state of pure love. And one is functioning, very simply, wisely. Now, if one functions that way, and one will realize that any comparison where the context of religion is concerned, the context of transcendence, is just our human folly. Can you take one bit of infinity and compare it with another? How are you going to measure infinity? How are you going to measure immortality? It's totally impossible. The deathless state is the immeasurable state. Sink your plummet. Am I using the right word? Into the eternal. Your little mind will soon end, and you will have been completely unsuccessful in measuring the infinite. You see, I keep harping on this non-finitude, non-temporality, and non-mortality, because it is very helpful for us functioning here and now, very helpful for so quietening the sense functions and the psyche, that the sense of transcendence can awake in us. When that sense of transcendence really awakes, it is the light within, and it dispels the darkness. That sense of transcendence, until the psyche is utterly purified, can get clouded over, just as the clouds on earth shut out the light of the sun. It's not that the sun doesn't come out. The sun is unconcerned with coming out or going in. It is the sun, that's that. But the phenomena which take place in manifestation on the limited finite scale on earth shuts out the light which lights the solar system. It's like that. So now, we shall all be going away tomorrow. So let us, as we go away, go mindfully, and our meeting will be endless. Our communion, our love, our interchange, interaction in the constructive, creative way will continuously go on in the silence, in the quiet. There are occasions during the year, that is to say from one summer school to another, when I may be deluded, or I may not, when I seem to know what's happening, not what's happening in terms of the event, but the state of so-and-so or so-and-so who was present at the summer school. And I notice that one's own psyche, one's own brain, is very quiet then. And it's not passing any judgments on the other person. It's that sort of experience which has helped to bring to light something of the deep significance. And Jesus tells the woman, neither do I condemn thee. The Jews, not one of them dared to hold up, take a stone and stone the woman. You see, neither do I condemn thee. Go thy way and sin no more. We can say that to ourselves. Let us go our way, sinning no more. And where there is the light of understanding, the illumination of true wisdom, and there is love, there is compassion, then sin cannot enter, cannot find lodgment in the psyche. You know how in so many of the discourses the Buddha says, they are presented in this form, that Mara, the death dealer, cannot enter, cannot find lodgment. And so the evil one vanishes, vanquished. That is only an artistic form in which to present a profound reality. All this happens within one's own self. And we have to take full count of that. Not shut ourselves out from anybody else. That doesn't mean imposing ourselves, intruding upon anybody and everybody else. But it does mean being sensitive and awake to the involvement with everyone else. Because this involvement is an actual fact of nature. You can't deny the fact. Of course you may. You may deny it and say that what I am saying is just wrong. Well, all right. Explore. Find out for yourself. Because what you find out for yourself is the most valid truth for you. So now, the time is at hand for this particular experience, the meeting this year, to terminate, as we call it. And in the changing process, if it has given rise to something which makes the light within shine brighter, then there is naturally present real peace and real happiness. Thank you all very much indeed, every one of you.